This episode of the Good Idea Podcast is part of a series of thought pieces that Control Risks is producing around the issue of critical minerals. I'm joined today by two of my esteemed colleagues, Yadira Orsini, who's been on the podcast before and leads on human rights in the ESG and sustainable business practice. Welcome, Yadira.
Thank you, Maria. Happy to be here again.
And a newcomer to the podcast, Rob Bales, who heads on sustainable supply chains for the practice.
Thank you, Maria.
So I'll start by setting the scene a little bit about why we're here. I know there's a lot that we can say about the issues around critical minerals, and we want to keep this quite focused on the issues affecting companies today and in the medium term. What's happening that matters, what you need to be paying attention to, and what you might be able to do to put yourself in a better position to handle these very tricky and multiplying challenges. The world, we know, needs energy transition rapidly. The market size of key energy transition minerals has doubled over the past 5 years, according to the IEA. The IEA also predicts another doubling of demand for those same minerals by 2030 in its least ambitious climate scenario, or growing 3.5 times to 2030 in its more ambitious climate scenario. The industries involved in the energy transition, or thinking about EV batteries, solar, other renewables, some of the more innovative technology industries and sectors are growing at pace. They are newish players, some of them, in this mining and mineral value chain, and money is flowing fast. There's, within that context, a concentration risk on sourcing. We know as well, 25 dominant countries, I think it was, and in some recent reports on critical minerals, among which probably a handful will dominate production growth in the next 10 years. Just to cite an example so we can kind of get a sense of the scale of this and the concentration of this, in a recent report by Human Rights Watch, the organization has said that by 2030, just Germany alone aims to get 80% of electricity from renewable energy sources. And as part of that, that would mean having 15 million all-electric cars registered. That energy transition requires significant amount of minerals such as lithium, cobalt, manganese and copper, those that you'll hear a little bit more during our discussion today about. And those resources are mostly located in Africa, Latin America, and Asia, and some more emerging and kind of developing economies within those regions. We know also there are significant impacts linked to those critical minerals, the ones that are underpinning the value chains and the success of the energy transition. With all that in mind, and all this kind of newness and the pace of growth and the reliance on these minerals, I'll turn first to Yadira to unpick what we mean by impacts. What are the impacts that come with these critical minerals that are often labeled sort of, you know, high risk, high impact, et cetera?
Yes, thanks, Maria. And I'll focus on your use of the term newness, because in fact, it's new, but it's not really new. What we are seeing, and when we talk about impacts, we're really just talking about the same impacts that we've seen with the mining industry that has been there for all these years. What we're seeing differently is a bit of an acceleration of those issues, which we'll touch on, I think, later down the line. But the impacts that we're talking about are basically the known impacts around environmental management, you know, water usage, pollution, all of those issues. The issue around working conditions, for example, with some elements becoming a bit more pervasive in some industries than others. And I'll give an example in a bit, but, you know, we're looking at health and safety issues as well. We're also looking at governance, the governance agenda in a lot of these countries, and how, you know, everything from how contracts are awarded to how do supply chains work, and the kind of legal frameworks that you have behind all of the governance of the industry. So if you look at a specific example around cobalt in the DRC, for example, which is something that has been on the agenda for quite a bit, it seems that it's kind of a microcosm of all of these issues all rolled into one. And so there's been many, many reports highlighting issues around working conditions and particularly around the prevalence of artisanal and small-scale mining in that particular commodity. The issue of child labor, for example, being quite critical, but also health and safety, quite very extreme conditions for some of these workers when it comes to health and safety. So you've got those points. You've also have issues around security and human rights because of the type of situations that you see companies face, the connection with illegal armed groups in a country like the DRC. And also issues around land. So land is also driving a lot of those impacts in terms of, you know, there's been quite a lot of reports around forced evictions. In the worst of cases, in the best of cases, you're looking at really poorly managed or poorly conducted resettlement programs. So those are the kind of impacts that we're talking about. Of course, we can't forget governance. And again, I've mentioned transparency. Unfortunately, there's a lot of corruption in how some of these contracts have been awarded. And that continues to be an element of the industry. So again, it's new, but it's not new. The impacts that we're looking at are pretty much the same impacts that we've been looking at in the industry for quite some time now.
That's a useful sense check, Yadira. And I'd like to get a bit later in our discussion to what companies in that value chain have been doing to manage those issues, because they're clearly, we know from the work that we do with our clients that they are not easily resolvable issues, but they are ones that companies have been mitigating, tackling for some years. And I think it'll be useful to focus in on that. But by the same turn, as I've said, they are tricky issues and to some extent inherent almost to those sectors, particularly in the upstream part of the sectors, or part of the value chain. So I want to turn to you, Rob, to, I guess, ask maybe a little bit of a provocative question. But hearing that list of quite fundamental and indisputably negative impacts that aspects of this value chain have, and thinking about it in the context of the mission of the energy transition, which is to have a positive impact, are we not really just simply displacing one impact for another?
Yes. Well, I think that's a fundamental question. I think it's one that certainly policymakers, civil society, NGOs, and many others are increasingly questioning, which is a clean energy transition and that climate imperative the same thing as what we define as a just transition? So to what degree are we going to pursue one goal, but to the detriment of another? And in this instance, I think that's really around the benefits of mining and extractive processes to local communities and host governance. So that's something that is being, I think, thought about a lot more. I think what it means for companies who, you know, will be thinking a lot about this around what their strategy is over the next 10 years, whether you be upstream or whether you be in the midstream or the downstream, is how can I gear up my supply chain and the way that I buy and the way I procure and source these raw materials in a way that can support that just transition? How can I actually do that? And obviously the way you do that and the way you approach that will depend on the type of business you are and where you sit in the supply chain.
I think it would be good to take a closer focus in on something now. Yadira, you usefully highlighted that a lot of the underlying impacts are not new. They've been tackled in the mining value chain for years. What is it now that makes these particularly challenging or problematic or kind of headline grabbing? You know, I mentioned one factor, which is just the rapidly growing demand and so size of the market for this. But is there anything else you can point out to us that explains the acuteness of these issues now?
Yeah, for sure. I think that there's at least three things to highlight here. The first one being that we're talking about new players. So yes, it's not a new industry. You have your mining players that have been there, but within that, there's a bit of change as well. So you've got new players coming on in the whole value chain. For instance, you're looking at investors, and they can be climate investors or just impact investors or all just regular investors that are stepping into this new area, and they don't really know what questions they need to ask. They know that there are issues, but they really need a lot of guidance in terms of what their due diligence needs to be, what are the most salient issues that they need to consider. So that's one example. Another example is, you know, downstream companies that are not used to playing in the mining space. And so they're not aware of what their role needs to be within where they fall within this mining value chain. But also from a human rights point of view, they're not aware of what their human rights responsibility is attached to that. Obviously, they're not causing a lot of these impacts, but they can be, in some cases, contributing to those or even directly linked. So that distinction becomes a little less clear.
Which you're drawing from the UNGP's
exactly.
Three so, levels of involvement. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, of relationship to see how an organization can be connected to a human rights impact, a negative human rights impact.
And I think the organizations that we've been engaging with recently, we've definitely seen a big spectrum on the level of kind of awareness, maturity, sophistication on these issues, even where there's a great intention and will to work on them. I've definitely seen that with you.
Yep. And you know, you do have new actors upstream. So for example, you've got your traditional mining big companies, but then we're looking more and more at the junior players, at the less mature type of companies that are coming onto the game, and they normally tend to have less standards or at least different approaches to the topic of sustainability. They haven't had the same level of experience that these big companies have had when it comes to dealing with some of these challenges. So there's a lot to learn within that space. So I think the players, the type of players that we're seeing, there is an element of difference there. The other thing is around the locations where these operations happen. Obviously, a lot of the times, you know, in more established sites, you do have already well-known, well-documented issues. But the problem you mentioned at the beginning around how much can you actually diversify some of these sources, and it takes you to some locations that are going to be the dominant players, and that's not going to change. And the type of issues and challenges associated to those locations are only going to remain there. If you look at what has been called, you know, these new mover countries, places like, I don't know, Bolivia, Indonesia, Madagascar, you're looking at places where the one concern, or at least the most often cited concern, has been lack of infrastructure development. And for us as sustainability professionals, we're saying, yes, that's an issue, but what about poor governance? What about, you know, poor enforcement if they do have the governance standards? What about the enforcement of that? You know, not the best track record on things like human rights or environmental stewardship or those kinds of things. So that's one element. You're also seeing a lot of places that are more fragile and conflict affected. And that creates a whole host of new challenges for companies. And one element that I would draw there is that connection precisely of climate risks compounded with security risks. And so you see that connection that is beginning to come out quite a lot in terms of how climate can actually lead migration. And then how does that fit in with fragile and conflict-affected environments. So that element of it, I think, is something that is going to become more front and center of the conversations. And then other places where you just have other type of challenges around social conflict or social stability. You know, a lot of places have opposition to mining. And in the worst of cases, again, you have repression to that opposition. You have criminalization of human rights defenders. So those are the agendas of the places where we're seeing this that are you know, not the best equipped to make these, to manage these issues, unfortunately. And I guess the last point that I'll say, which has been referenced already by other colleagues in other podcasts, but I think from a sustainability point of view, raise an interesting question, is new technologies. So we are seeing new technologies that are coming on board, and you see things around the discussion on seabed mining, for example, which is so controversial. So the arrival of new technologies is very positive in a lot of cases, but it does raise some quite significant sustainability questions in other situations.
What you're describing sounds very much like a captive market. And I think that chimes well with how some of the companies we're working with sort of feel about being part of this value chain, and a frustration with the lack of diversification. But I guess coming to terms with all that scene setting that you've done and the context in which companies are involved in this value chain, I might turn to Rob to just change tack a little bit. Within all this, we know there's also regulatory pressures increasing on companies' obligations to manage these issues. And then we have that issue of companies needing to move fast and capture part of the market, all of this. How are you, maybe you can give us kind of a little bit more of a kind of tangible breakdown of how you're advising companies to work through these issues?
Yeah, absolutely. Sure. And, you know, and I guess that's the, for any company at any stage in the supply chain, that's the thing that they need to be thinking about now, is that in a volatile and constrained market, how am I going to gear up my supply chain and sourcing in a way that's going to be able to handle this? And as I said to earlier about that thing around the just transition, minimize harms and maximize positive impacts, so that in the next 10 years, I'm on the right side of sustainability. And that's really the question. I think if you look at how companies are dealing with that, many companies are thinking about that in different ways. Some companies are not thinking about it at all yet. I look at some of those really big car manufacturers, Tesla, vertical integration. What that allows you to do really is it's more of a supply resilience move, because it allows you to shore up supply of a scarce material, but it has the added benefit of giving you much more control over the standards and conditions of production through and up the value chain. But of course, you know, it's only really the big players who can make vertical integration moves. Lots of companies looking at offtake agreements. Again, there's a lot of business case and business value in offtake agreements. But again, it's going to give you an ability to exert more control over your supply chain. But those cases are few and far between. And I think for most companies, particularly at the downstream level, it's around thinking about how do I source and procure my raw materials, whether that's directly, whether I'm directly buying these raw materials, or how I'm procuring those materials, because they may be embedded in a manufactured product that I'm then selling on to the consumer. So that's really a basic sustainable procurement and sustainable sourcing question. And of course,
I guess because Yudhira gave us a sense check earlier, maybe you can give us a sense check now. I mean, getting to grips with all of that is obviously essential, particularly at the downstream side. And it sounds very easy on paper, but ultimately we know there are barriers to actually accessing all that information and managing it. Can you tell us a bit more about some of the barriers that companies face with regards to getting access to the information they need to map and understand and get, I guess, a little bit more to grips and control over that?
Sure, absolutely. And maybe it's also worth just contextualizing this against the backdrop of all of the due diligence, regulation and obligations that we now see. I think something like 10 or 11 supply chain due diligence obligations
about that
in the last 2 years alone, a patchwork of those around the world. So all putting pressure on supply chains, really a core set of demands coming through. It's around supply chain visibility, so traceability. What you can't see in the supply chain is ultimately misunderstood as a risk, and therefore it can't be managed. So number one, traceability in supply chains, mapping supply chains, and then ultimately being able to risk assess supply chains. the reality is for most companies, those things aren't easy to do, particularly with critical minerals and rare earth metals, precisely because we know that some of the countries that these minerals and metals are being mined and extracted and processed in don't often have the layers of transparency that we might like to see, which would enable companies to be able to map and trace their supply chains. So often that's coming up against supplier intransigence or an unwillingness to provide the kind of what they call the nth tier visibility, where exactly are my raw materials coming from that the buyer might want. And, you know, we're seeing,
I'd love to have it if I was a company at the click of a button, wouldn't I? You know, just generate it give me a software platform, generate the information. Let me have a nice visual of my map. I mean, that's certainly what I would be asking for and aiming for.
Oh, exactly. Exactly. Well, and the reality is, I think a lot of the technology is there, but there's fundamental blockages you can't get past. Anybody can introduce a piece of technology, but if you can't get the traceability data from your supplier, then the technology doesn't count for anything. So there's challenges like that, of course, and companies are going to have to navigate that. And particularly if you're a smaller company, you have less leverage over your suppliers. It's very difficult to exert that pressure, either to enforce a particular, you know, code of conduct or standard that you may wish to see. And don't forget, most of the time, these companies are buying from hundreds and hundreds of tier one suppliers.
But there are cascading code of conduct clauses and obligations that are flowing down, theoretically, all the way down to those untraceable suppliers.
Exactly.
Just a little bit problematic in and of itself, isn't
it? That's exactly how to do it, I think. Mm. There is another piece of this, of course, which is, and I think this links back to what Yudhira was saying about some of the impacts. There's also quite significant downstream impact to critical minerals, which is the whole e-waste thing, which is not new, of course. We know that there's been mounting piles of e-waste building up in particularly in Western markets, mobile phones, which are being thrown away, something like 20 million tons of e-waste or technology now sitting around in the UK alone, which is not being used. Mm-hmm. So you've got the waste issue, but then really you've got the circularity argument, which is actually, at the end of the day, if I want to break or challenge the traditional linear supply chain of take, make, waste, then what I need to be doing is leaving those critical raw materials in usage for a lot longer than they are currently. Talk about the, I think it's the 4 or 5 R's of circularity, the reuse, the repair, the remanufacture, and then ultimately the last of those, recycling. Whereas actually recycling is still quite an energy intensive process. What you really want to be doing is repairing those materials and leaving them in use longer, which of course is beneficial to companies because you get the value from those materials longer. So I think that's going to be the circularity piece is going to be pretty critical. And
we know that we've certainly been talking about how there were discussions in the IFRS to direct some of that eventually, maybe in longer time, framework to look more at natural capital dependencies and companies reporting on that. And I guess circularity is a nice way to think ahead about how to mitigate what your natural capital dependencies will be, and then the, obligations and accountability linked to that too.
That's absolutely, yeah. I think, of course, our listeners may or may not be aware of something called the Corporate Sustainability Reporting Obligation, which is the new non-financial reporting directive here in the EU. It's pretty robust. It's asking companies to report on, you know, their risks, impacts, and opportunities around ESG. There is now a resource and circularity related standard within that, which is going to be asking companies to report on a quite complex set of resource inflow and outflow data, KPIs, and metrics. So, I mean, the good news is that hopefully is going to be aligning the sector, and that will drive companies to think more about how they manage those resources and raw materials. But let's face it, we are a long way off circular supply chains. And I just saw this statistic before we joined the podcast that apparently only less than 1% of critical minerals are currently recovered. So we're a long way from a circular critical mineral supply chain. So companies will have to, for a long time yet, think about this in a sustainable sourcing, sustainable procurement mindset.
Yeah, with the pace of the industry, the way it's going, it's, I guess, what we like to call building the plane while you're flying it, but a necessary step. Yudaira, I want to come back to you on what your experience has been recently advising companies through these issues. You mentioned some of the really, much more on the social side, I'd like to emphasize with you and your experience recently, some of the difficult to untangle issues that you're working on with companies.
Yeah, so I think we've said this time and time again, and I think more now more than ever, it makes more sense. You know, the companies just really cannot cut corners around this. There is just no way you cannot get around dealing with some of these issues now more and more. And I think this is only just going to get more intensive. You know, the global contexts have changed, the local contexts have changed. And yes, everyone kind of says this, but I think it really holds truth to it in terms of, you know, we're seeing actors more and more organized on the ground, more informed, more connected. You know, I've been having conversations.
You mean the rights holders?
Yeah, rights holders or organizations that work alongside them. And having very informed conversations about the CSDDD in places like Brazil, in places like Colombia, or, you know, in Asia, where you would think, oh, that's so far away.
You're referring to the European or the proposed European directive.
Yes, the proposed.
For sustainability due diligence.
Yeah, the corporate sustainability directive. So they are aware of these things happening. They know that companies are being held accountable more and more for all those pieces of regulation that Rob was talking about just now. So actors are aware of this. They are becoming more and more familiarized with this. So that accountability space has been changing quite a lot. And it's really exciting to see how that has been changing. It's really exciting to see as well how a lot of investors are upping their game as well in terms of sophisticating the type of questions that they're asking in really curious to see, you know, how they can use that leverage even more. The question that we get all the time is, how do I use my leverage? When is the best moment? What are the tools that are out there that I can use? So lots of interesting conversations from rights holders, but also companies themselves, sophisticated, you know, a bit more sophisticated in terms of understanding their role a little bit better. You do have the, you know, occasional outlier that doesn't think that there is much that they have to do. And again, we come back to this point of what is your relationship to a particular impact. But those will continue to be out there. We can't, you know, pretend that everything is perfect now, but because those businesses are still out there as well. But the other thing I would say perhaps is, you know, in line with this point that we've been making, that this is not really new, the standards are out there. There's so many resources, good resources out there, you know, by the likes of the ICMM, the International Council on Mining and Metals. They have really done some great job at standardizing what best practice looks like for
and
the
sector.
And
strong industry consensus around that.
Super strong industry consensus with a lot of players there that hold some of these mines that we're talking about in terms of critical minerals that hold the markets there. But you see great standards around things like community engagement, free, prior, and informed consent, management of tailings, all of these issues that have been quite problematic in the past. So the standards are out there. Again, we come back to the point of how can you implement them better? And in recognition of that, these are not problems that one single company can solve on their own. These are problems that are going to require now more than ever collaboration and partnership, not just among sectors. So we're seeing trade associations, we're seeing sector industry associations working, collaborating quite a lot on these issues at a company level, at an investor level, but also partnerships on the ground and looking at you know, civil society organizations, community groups, and other companies facing similar issues at a country level, and with governments. So we're also seeing governments kind of upping their game on these topics. So I think that's I didn't want to sound like a party pooper at the beginning, but there are some really interesting dynamics happening that kind of give me hope in terms of how we can collectively manage some of these issues.
I think that's a good kind of high note to move towards, I guess, our reflections at the end of this discussion. We usually go to key takeaways, but I think this arena is a bit too tricky to try to issue a kind of key takeaway. But maybe it's more about how we can frame this, hopefully, for a company in terms of what do you think, Rob, a company's perspective should be around these issues now, wherever it sits in the value chain.
Yeah, sure. And I think just going back to what Yadira said there, best practice, whatever part of the supply chain you sit, best practice for extraction, production, processing of raw materials exists. It's existed for some time. It's really the implementation of that that is key. So don't reinvent the wheel. The same if you're downstream and you're buying and you're exerting, you know, due diligence through your supply chain. We know what best practice looks like. So go away, find out what that is and implement that. And I guess the other thing I would say, and I'm thinking about this, if I'm a company, thinking about what's the business and the supply chain that I want to be in 10 years time, and actually start configuring my business and my supply chain for that now, rather than managing incrementally and firefighting. So do I really want to test or challenge or turn on its head my business model in whatever shape or form that looks like? And if not, how do I put in place the systems and the processes for that supply chain due diligence that I'm going to need to have to serve me in a much more constrained and volatile marketplace 10 years from now?
So yeah, I guess developing a deliberate strategy around these things and then working backwards from that. And you mentioned some of the strategies earlier that were available to companies. I think that's a useful way to think about it. Yadira, how about you?
I guess if you look at it from two perspectives here, if you're a junior company, if you're a new player, a newcomer to this, whether you're a company or an investor, there's, again, enough out there. So you need to do your homework. Basically, you need to spend time to organize this. You need to dedicate resources to this. Don't cut corners. There's enough out there, enough experience out there, enough knowledge out there to be able to perform to the expected level that regulation on one hand, but also stakeholders want to see companies behave when it comes to critical mineral extraction or investments. And if you are not a new player, then, you know, if you're already doing things that work for you, continue on that path, expand and make sure that those linkages are there within your company with other peers. And let's not forget about that best practice. Let's not, you know, ignore all of this knowledge collectively that the sector has and just make use of that and tackle the hard issues. It's easier said than done. I acknowledge that, but there's just no way around it.
And lots of experience to draw from.
Yep. And yeah, a lot of it, again, know where you are, understand the context where you are. The issues might be the same, but differences in that operating context will make it far more challenging if you're really not aware of who your stakeholders are, what the dynamics are, and how that plays into your strategy.
Yeah. Thank you both for your insights today and the broad but very tangible discussion. Thanks so much, Yadira, for your, as usual, lucid and cogent inputs into what's been a fascinating discussion.
Thank you. Always happy to chat about these issues.
And thanks so much, Rob, for joining us on the podcast for the first time, but what I'm sure won't be the last time.
Pleasure.
If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to subscribe. And be sure to check out our other podcasts as well, such as Decrypt, the podcast making sense of the cyber and technology issues impacting business. For all our analysis and information about services we offer to organizations worldwide, visit controlrisks.com.